Hi there, I'm Ted Kravitz. This isn't one of my notebooks, but this is Driving with J9.
Good day and welcome to Driving with J9. Joining us today, all the way from London, is Formula One pundit and Sky Sports pit lane reporter Ted Kravitz. Hi Ted, welcome to our News 24 Motoring podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us for this episode.
Hello there, it's a pleasure to be with you, yes. greetings from cold London. Autumn has turned. So our summer didn't last very long, and now we're approaching winter. But yeah, good to be with you.
Yeah, it's such a treat to speak to you, and especially about your new book called F1 Insider Notes from the Pit Lane, which has just come in hot off the press here in South Africa. And I think if there's anyone who doesn't know anything about the sport, your book is the perfect guide to get the ins and outs about it, and also a fantastic recap of the last 30 years of your career. But what made you decide to write F1 Insider?
Well, I think you sometimes have to have a bit of time behind you in order to write about some of the experiences. It kind of helps to have some stories to tell. And I was, as I'm approaching 30 years working in Formula One, 2027 will be 30 years for me. I thought now is a good time. And I also thought, because it's the 75th anniversary of the World Championship, started, of course, in 1950, that it was also a good time. And also because there's a rule change coming for next year, so we're going to see a little bit of a different Formula One. And it seemed to me that there'll be so much to talk about next year with the new rules and regulations and how that's going to work, that now is a good time to kind of take stock and look back. So, yeah, a few reasons there. And it was quite hard work. I'm not sure I'll be doing another one anytime soon, but yeah, I'm glad that people like it.
Yeah. I must say, I was doing some research, and honestly, I'm a few episodes into this podcast now, but this is probably the first I've been properly nervous. But that's probably because you're an actual journalist as well, and you've mentioned not only in your book that asking the right questions to get great interaction from the drivers is something you've learned from Michael Schumacher. He also once told you, take your journey with you. But what would you say has been your biggest lesson in the pit lane these past few decades?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm always learning. So you learn something every day. It's remarkable, actually. You think about the race to come, and you think, oh well, I've covered all circumstances, really. And then something always comes up to surprise you. I mean, this weekend just passed, as we're talking, I've just come back from Austin, Texas. And it was a fairly usual race, and things played out. And then after the race, we got this information from the sports governing body, the FIA, that they wanted to see some people from the Red Bull team about a grid incident. And we all thought that was maybe somebody left the grid late, or they had a guest who went onto the grid who didn't know where they were meant to be at whatever time. And then it turned out that it was a mechanic who was on the grid pulling off a piece of tape that the McLaren team had put next to Lando Norris's grid box to show him where to line up his front wheels with the starting box to get the best start. And that is never, we've never heard that before. I mean, we've heard about them putting this this tape on the side of the pit wall. Yeah. It's allowed to do it.
Yeah.
And so every day is a learning day, and that's really what makes it refreshing and exciting, is that something will always happen unusual. To actually get you going. So it's a pleasure to do that. You talked about Michael Schumacher saying you take your journey with you. That's absolutely true. Yeah. Traveling to the races is sometimes a bit of a challenge, getting to places in a timely and efficient way. Missed connections, the slightest thing can happen. A rainstorm over Chicago can delay the flight coming into Austin, and then you miss your connection out of Dallas, and you're stuck in the country for another day and a half. But they are the frustrating bits. But yeah, you're always learning, and there's always something going on.
Yeah, you've seen drivers come and go. You've seen multiple championships won and lost. You've been there for the biggest dramas and the most exciting victories. You were out in the middle of the Renault Crashgate, the Hamilton Alonso blowout, the 2005 six-car days. And I get goosebumps just thinking about it, because you're literally living every F1 lover's dream. But what has been your most memorable moment in Formula One?
I mean, so many of them. You're right, and you never know when these things are going to happen. You know, going into my first championship decider in 1997 in Jerez. You know, we didn't know that Michael Schumacher was going to drive into the side of Jacques Villeneuve, and there'd be this great controversy about that. Austria 2002, we didn't know that there was going to be a change of position on the line, and these things, you know, come up. Indianapolis 2005 was a little bit different, because we'd had an idea throughout the weekend that the guys running on Michelin tires had a little bit of a problem, but we never expected them all. We always thought there'd be a solution. We never expected there only to be sort of six cars in the race. It was ridiculous. And then the 2007 season, as you say, the blowout with Alonso and Hamilton, you could see it coming. And sometimes you don't realize that these are sort of very eventful seasons as they're unfolding.
Yeah.
But only when you get to look back at it and write a book, for example, then you think, wow, that was an incredible time. But I would say, to answer your question, any last race championship deciders, there's always a tension. Actually, the best part of those weekends sometimes isn't the race itself. Yeah. It's the anticipation on Saturday night after qualifying. And I always like, on Saturday night after qualifying, to take a walk up and down the pit lane once the sun goes down. And the pit lanes have lit up with floodlights. And you just see a few of the teams still fettling the cars and just making last minute checks before they go home for the evening. And there's a real sense of anticipation that evening before a last race championship decider. It's a real magical time. And I'm lucky to be able to do it. So yeah, those are the memorable times when you don't know what's going to happen. You know, the next day it could be Schumacher world champion, it could be Villeneuve, it could be Hamilton, it could be Alonso. We're going to have a championship decided this year, where it could be Verstappen, it could be Piastri, it could be Norris. And you just, everything, the slate is clean, and it's that anticipation. So that's a favorite time for me.
No, that's amazing. You're quite a fascinating human being, and from what I've come across, just interviews you've done and so forth, you're incredibly down to earth. And like I said, I was nervous earlier, but immediately I think your voice is just so soothing and comforting that I feel so at home just speaking to you. And I read some Reddit comments the other day, and everyone was saying the nicest things about you. But one comment was particularly funny about a race fan that said you were giving breastfeeding tips to his wife. I don't know if you can remember that, but but on a serious note, though, what would 10-year-old Theodore think you would be one day? How did you fall in love with radio, and then with Formula One?
I probably wouldn't think that I was giving breastfeeding. I mean, I've got three kids, and so I was very involved in. I've got three daughters. I got very involved in bringing them up, and I would always do the night feeds.
Yeah.
So I'm fully committed dad. I think the tip was, don't be afraid of using formula milk, because it helps the baby sleep at night, and the more sleep you can get as a parent, then the better it is for you and the baby. I think that just to defuse that, sounds more weird than it actually was. I mean, a 10-year-old Theodore would have thought that motor racing was always just going to be my hobby and my sort of sporting passion, my favorite sport. Probably wouldn't have seen a way into the sport to work in it. So would be pretty surprised. He would have probably thought, I thought you were going to go into radio, because that's what captured my attention when I was young at that age. just between sort of 10 and 15, I kind of liked to stay up at night when, after my parents thought they'd put me to bed, and I'd have a little radio, a little, you know, transistor radio. It's a long time ago now. growing up in the 70s and the 80s, we didn't have the internet back then, believe it or not. And it always encaptured my attention. And there was a romance to radio that you were listening underneath your bed sheets and somewhere else. And there was somebody talking in a studio, and then there were lots of other people talking and listening there and phoning in and stuff like that. So that was always what I thought I was going into. It was only when the opportunity to join the Formula One production came up in the end of 1996 that I thought, okay, well, you know, why not? This will be fun. And I've been there ever since.
Oh, that's amazing. But how much did Murray Walker and James Allen also have an influence on your career?
Mm. Murray Walker had a huge influence because I didn't realize it at the time, but I was, when I was working with him in the commentary box, I was just taking in and understanding and moments that I would come back and reflect on what he was doing at what time have made much more sense to me as a reporter. So Murray taught me how to project, how to deliver, how to slow down sometimes and then speed up and then get louder with your voice sometimes if there's a point you want to make or it's exciting, but then slow down because nobody wants to be shouted at on TV. And to keep some of that childlike enthusiasm that I had when I was 10 watching Formula One on the TV, to make sure I keep some of that because that's important. And then James Allen taught me the nuts and bolts of being a pit reporter. I mean, he wrote the book on how to be a pit reporter. There weren't really any full-time pit reporters before James Allen. So he taught me about the effectiveness of just coming in along in the middle of a race commentary, dropping in some information, telling your viewers why it's relevant, and then and then shutting up, basically being, you know, stop talking and then carry on, you know, allowing the commentators to carry on. And no one encapsulates a Formula One story like James Allen and still does. He's very good. And so, you know, in Murray Walker and James Allen, I really learned from the best. And so I was lucky to be in that position.
Yeah. I mean, just on that, so to be a pit lane reporter, you clearly need to have a very good eye for details and finding the stories we don't see on the screen. Why do you think you've aced this made-up job like Anthony Davidson said in the beginning of your book?
Well, he's a racing driver, so he doesn't understand that there's lots to be observed in the pits and then reported on. He just drives cars. There are still some things that I'll point out to him. It's like, oh, I never knew that. I said, well, there you go. There's the job of the pit reporter. It helps that I'm observant. A lot of the I don't know whether you see sometimes in the newspapers or online, there's a spot the difference competition. Can you tell the 10 subtle changes in these two pictures? And I always loved them. And that that's effectively spotting upgrades on cars. So you look at a car and there's a bit on the floor and you think, well, that's different. You know, I didn't see that. And so that you're observant and that helps. And then you go away and you research it and you ask another team. And they say, oh, yeah, you know, they needed that because they weren't getting the downforce in the middle speed corners. And now we're going to the Austrian Grand Prix or whatever, and they need something for this kind of circuit. And there you've got a story. So that's being observant helps. Being curious, obviously, with all journalism is important. And wanting to filter out some of the stories that aren't going to be relevant or that aren't going to affect the racing, and giving them less priority to something that is going to affect the racing and affect people's understanding and therefore their enjoyment and appreciation of what they're watching. That's really what it comes down to. Mm. You know, you can come on TV and say, oh, look at the soft tire. It's 0.3 seconds quicker than the medium tire. But if they're all on the soft tire, then that's not relevant.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got somebody racing someone else who is on a different tire, then it's relevant. So you have to remember what all this engineer speak, as I sometimes call it. It's all well and good, but it has to be relevant to what people are watching.
Yeah. I saw one of your Instagram posts where you were giving away some of your actual notebooks. And yep. I zoomed in on one of the posts, like you could win it if you ordered your book. I think it was in a competition yep. you were running away. But goodness, I don't think anyone would be able to make out your shorthand anyway. But it would still be really cool to have. How many notebooks do you think you've written in over the years, and what do you write in it?
So I've probably get through about 5 or 6 a season.
Wow.
Because they cover about 4 races.
Yeah.
I'll probably get through about 5 or 6 a season. And I'll start the weekend with timings of which press conferences are where. So
yeah.
Immediately I'll start when the drivers are talking and which press conferences are what time, and then I'll write down what the drivers are saying. So it really is a notebook in that sense of you're noting down some things that the drivers have said that might be relevant for the weekend. Then I'll write down some ideas about what I want to say when I'm doing a bit. So the producer will say, oh, we want you to do a bit before qualifying. Minute and a half in the pit lane, and so I'll start writing down some ideas about what to say in them. And then when it gets to the bit that's called part of the program, it's called Ted's Notebook.
Yeah.
Then I'll divide each page, one page into 5 teams.
Yeah.
So it'll be in championship order. So it'll be McLaren at the top, then Ferrari, then Mercedes, then Red Bull,
yeah.
or the other way around, and then Aston Martin, then. The next page will be Alpine, Racing Bulls, Haas, Williams, Sauber.
Yeah.
And then each driver will get a little subsection of that. And I'll write down what happened to their qualifying session or race.
Yeah.
And then any thoughts about what was happening to give context to how their race was or any events or when they pitted or whatever. And then a thought on the last line. It's why I have to write so small. Because the notebook has to be big enough, or rather small enough, to fit in my back pocket, because
yeah.
I need to carry around a load of other stuff. and so an idea, a line to remind me of something that they'd said that I'd written down earlier in the notebook.
Yeah.
So whether, for example, I don't know, the Sauber team boss Jonathan Wheatley had talked about how they're well prepared for next year. I'll just put JW on 26, for example.
Right. Yeah.
And then I'll read it and I'll remember to say, oh, and there was this news line that actually, you know, they might be scrapping for points at the back of the field at the moment, but Sauber are well prepared for 2026. So watch out for them next year.
Okay.
And that's all it will be. So it's literally notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a piece of paper.
The very first page in your book, you write about how Ed Sheeran basically says the F1 show is literally like a circus.
Yes.
And I don't think people realize just how much behind the scenes work really goes into it. How much research and planning do you need to do before a race weekend? Or do you ride the wave based on what you observe come Thursday media days and the free practice sessions?
And That's right. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt. You do need to prepare. It's no use just turning up and starting afresh. You need to be reading constantly throughout the week, and there'll be lots that goes into your head that you'll come to need later. And you need to have an idea about the features that you're going to do.
Yeah.
Because the other thing I do apart from the notebook is some features with drivers. So you'll have to, it takes time to your brain, you know, to sort of brew ideas like a good cup of coffee, and then you come up with some ideas. And so you might use some of those ideas and you might not use some of those ideas, but I'm always thinking about the weekend to come. And what struck me about that conversation with Ed Sheeran was that, you know, here is a guy who knows very much what it's like to be doing stadium tours around the world and moving a music act from city to city.
Yeah.
And yet he was impressed at how or struck at how Formula One was a circus. And I was like, wow, if Ed Sheeran, who is a worldwide singing songwriting superstar, thinks F1 is a circus, then it really must be a circus, because he'd know what a circus looks like in terms of his his music production. Yeah. So that's why I started the book like that.
And so fitting. Yeah. You write about Ted's notebook in chapter 18 of your book. But just how briefly, how did Ted's notebook come about? And what's the turnaround time for you to prep these features on an F1 weekend? Because I think your notebook, there's no rehearsals, there's no, you know, it's one take, you know? So yeah, how much time do you literally have to prep before you go live?
Yeah, so I have about an hour. So from the checkered flag, the checkered flag, say a race takes an hour and a half, checkered flag will be an hour and a half, maybe 40 minutes. And then I'll do some interviews with the team bosses that'll get played out. Mm. That'll lead us probably about up to 55 minutes. And then from the top of the next hour, we do the post-race analysis. Yeah. So Simon and Anthony and Karun and people on the analysts, Jensen Button or Martin Brundle or whoever, they'll talk for about an hour. And it's during that hour that I have the preparation time. I need the preparation time to go and talk to the teams, check with the drivers, any information I need, mm-hmm. write up all the notes, and then we're live at the top of the next hour.
Yeah.
So it takes about an hour, and then the more considered pieces I do, the VT pieces, they can sometimes take 2 or 3 days working in and out. A McLaren piece I did on the weekend in Texas. I'd gone and filmed at the McLaren factory a few days before we left for the US.
Yeah.
And so that had taken some time. And then the story kept changing because the drivers said some things on Thursday, and then that had to be backed up with what the team bosses said on Friday, and then there was more. And so we were editing that up to about a couple of hours before it went out.
Crazy.
So sometimes these pieces take a while to get right. Yeah.
You also write about Suzuka 2014 in your book. Was that the most challenging time to do your job at that traumatic weekend of Jules Bianchi's crash? How did you go about it, and how do you deal with disasters like that?
Yes, it was very upsetting for everybody because we hadn't had a fatality in Formula One for so long, and there are many people who didn't remember Imola 94, where we lost Ayrton Senna and Roland Ratzenberger, and then you know, there'd been Antoine Hubert, the Formula 2 driver who died at Spa a year or so before that, and it was just extremely shocking. And when the race started and it was in dark conditions and it was raining, we were all kind of going through it with our fingers crossed, thinking, you know, hoping that nothing was going to happen. And then when it did, it was very, very sad, very upsetting for everybody. I tried to minimize the intrusive effect of the media can have in some of these situations. Obviously, you know, we're asking questions of people, the team, the FIA, who don't really have anything to say or don't really want to say anything in that moment, even if they do have something to say. So just persuading everybody, you know, my colleagues and throughout other channels and just to, you know, let's just back off a little bit here.
Yeah.
There's nothing to be achieved, absolutely nothing to be achieved by pushing too hard to try and get some information. You know, I think everybody knows the basics of what's happened. There's not much more to say, so let's not push too hard. So that was a way of dealing with it, was just to remind everybody to be respectful, and then to let it play out, and there was only a certain time that we were on TV for, and maybe that's a good thing in a sense, and that we don't have to be standing outside, you know, constantly reporting, although of course other journalists do. When you have these disasters, they have to stand outside reporting, and it's difficult when there's nothing to say. So we wrapped up, we ended our program, and then And then we sort of packed up and left. And yeah, that was a very, very difficult weekend.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But tell me, why is it taking so long for us to see a woman on the F1 grid? You know, as a racer. There's the academy, there's all these programs. But I mean, we're going into 2026 and there still isn't a female racer on the grid. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It's a very good question, because there's no reason, there's no limitation for, as far as I'm concerned, to why we shouldn't see a female Formula One driver. There have been five or six in the past, but it's been so long since the last one. I remember watching, and then in the Brabham was Giovanna Amati, and I thought, oh, that's great. You know, I hope she does well.
Yeah.
And then sort of nothing for 30 years. So I think it's good that we have these programs. I think W Series, which I was proud to be a one of the sort of founding broadcasters for, did the most. And F1 Academy with Susie Wolf has done a lot to bring on the drivers. And you see in a lot of the drivers, you see Formula One standard, you know, racecraft in one driver, strategy nous in another driver. You see physical strength in another driver. But at the moment, we haven't all sort of paired all of those up in one particular driver. Dorian Pin or Pin is very good. Maya Verg, who's they're in contention for the F1 Academy Championship. Abby Pulling, who won the F1 Academy last year. She's going well in British Formula 3. It's called GB3 here. And I just think we need a little bit more time for those programs to bring through the drivers and to find the person who has all of those things. Because it's not just female drivers. You have, heaven knows, there are male drivers who none of them absolutely, you know, you only get a generational talent like Max Verstappen or Lewis Hamilton or, you know, Sebastian Vettel or whatever, Fernando Alonso, you know, once in a while. And you get plenty of good drivers. And we just need a little bit more time. But I would be surprised if by the next 10 years, by 2030, 2032, 2035, if we don't have a female driver, I'd be very surprised if we don't.
Just coming to the current season and how things are standing now, we have 5 races to go, including the Mexican GP this weekend, and Max is really looking like he's going to easily claim his next title. But anything can happen. We don't know what's going to happen. There's no clear winner. But what has happened to the McLarens after the dominant form all year? Everyone was so sure the driver's title would go to either Lando or Oscar, and now we just don't know. I have this crazy conspiracy theory, but how would you explain the reverse dominance currently on the grid? Is it purely down to pressure and the McLaren boys being inside their own heads? Or is Max really just a beast? What is the logical explanation?
Those are two factors. The pressure on the McLaren guys is immense, because they've never fought for a Formula One championship where they're leading it, and they've been leading it for so long. Obviously, Lando tried to challenge Max for last year's championship, but didn't quite get there. And Max has the nous and the ability. There's no pressure on Max as well, being the hunter. He just has to go out and win the race, and then just hope everything something happens to the leaders. Piastri has been the epitome of cool, calm, and collected. I think we'll see that again. I don't think he's lost that. I'd be surprised, because that was just such a sort of innate part of his makeups, that he was calm under pressure. He's just had a couple of bad races, but I would expect, certainly Brazil, which is the next but one race, and maybe Mexico for him to get back onto the podium. But it's astonishing for that Piastri hasn't been on the podium since Monza in early September. So that's incredible.
Yeah.
And the other reason, of course, not only that Max is just a machine, but that Red Bull car has been being developed still, and I believe there's still one more upgrade to that Red Bull car toward between now and the end of the year. So that car's about to get even quicker, and that car driver combination is now the Red Bull and Verstappen is now the fastest on the grid. So what Oscar needs to do is to just get back onto the podium, keep finishing second, and that's okay. Of course, the complication of that is that Lando seems to be quite quick at the moment, and that's taking those second places away from Oscar.
Yeah.
But to be 40 points, Oscar ahead of Max.
Yeah.
If Oscar still finishes second, then and Max is first, then he should be okay.
Yeah.
But he will need to win a race.
Yeah.
Orlando will need to win a race if they're to secure. But then that's the mark of a champion. When it's when your back's up against the wall and you need to deliver and you need to push on and win when it's important. That is what people talk about, a champion's drive, don't they?
And
Oscar will need to have a champion's drive before now and the end of the year. He can't just keep hoping that circumstances work out for him, even if they might.
Yeah.
He needs to go and grab it. So, yeah, fascinating season.
Do you know what the math is for Max to take this title?
Well, I mean, having just said that if he finishes second, I mean, let's ignore the sprint races, but there are five races left, and if it's an 8-point difference, then that would be the 40. That would be the 40 points that he needs. But you know, of course, you get it's 25 points for a win, 18 points for seconds. So that's only seven points. So if we seven times five, that's 35. So you know, that's ignoring the sprint races.
Yeah.
That's why I said if Max wins and Oscar is second, then Oscar still wins.
Yeah.
But that's ignoring the sprint races.
Yeah. Basically, the McLaren boys need to be on the podium for the next few races, I think.
They do. Well, Oscar needs to be second.
Yeah.
And Lando will have... I think that's why people are starting, probably wrongly, in my opinion, to say, you know, that McLaren should now say to Lando, I'm sorry, you're not going to finish second.
Right.
If we can only finish second, we're going to make sure that it's Oscar who finishes second and not you. I almost think that McLaren would rather lose the championship than do that.
Mm.
I don't know that for sure because we haven't asked them yet.
Yeah.
But I imagine that they'd rather just keep it sporting between the two, and if that means that Max comes in and steals wins the driver's championship, then they might just consider that's how motor racing goes. I'd like to think that's what they would do rather than use team orders.
You've had some hectic confrontations when drivers misinterpret what you've asked them. Max is a good example with the whole Jonathan Wheatley comment and the controversial 2021 Abu Dhabi race. But how do you move on from that when a driver, when an interview doesn't go down well? Do the drivers forgive and forget quickly? How do you move on? Like, especially after the whole Red Bull boycott and so forth.
Yes, I think the drivers have got more pressing things to do. They've got to drive the car, so you know, it's just a natural process. I think some journalists sometimes ask questions that people don't particularly like. You can either gloss over them and think, oh, you know, what a stupid question, or you can just give a normal answer. Or if you get annoyed and you think it's happening quite a lot as a driver, then you know, you can make representations to the to people like me, and then you go and have a chat and understand each other's positions. But funnily enough, you know, you'll always find, I mean, James Allen, my predecessor, was telling me the other day about how he had a huge row with Ross Brawn once because he'd said something about Ferrari that Ross Brawn hadn't liked. But they, you go and talk about it, and actually when you talk about it, and you know, I had chats with Max after he didn't like a question or something I said, and actually you learn more about the person in that moment when you're having a sort of grown-up discussion about it. And that's more, you think at the time, oh dear, you know, this is gonna damage our relationship, but actually when you discuss it, you learn more about each other, and oftentimes that can improve the relationship. You don't think it at the time, but funnily enough, it can. And so, you know, it's just that it's a very competitive world, obviously, and people want to put their point of view in the way that they want to. And in the end, you know, I'm only asking for my viewers. It's not that I want to know for my own. I mean, obviously I'm curious, but I'm asking that because it's the question that my viewers want answered. You know, whatever it is. But sometimes, you know, we can word a question wrong and it can get misinterpreted. But that happens in that's just part of daily life in F1. So it encourages you to think carefully about your question. Sometimes if you just say something off the cuff, then that's not the best way to do it. So it's a lesson. As I said earlier, you know, we're always, every day is a school day, we're always learning about how to do our job better.
I mean, just on Lewis Hamilton, it's taken him most of this year to finally find some form, it seems now. Why do you think he struggled so much? And do you think there's any chance of him seeing the podium in the last remaining races?
Yes, I hope so. I would very much hope he would be on the podium, just because he certainly has, you know, every season's been on the podium at least, and more. So I think he struggled because the Ferrari was so different, both in terms of how the car worked and then how the team worked around him to what he was used to at McLaren and Mercedes before that. And it's just taken a bit of time just to adapt to that, because you can adapt to things quite quickly and get up to a certain level of performance, but it's that last bit of performance that makes the difference, that last few tenths of a second. And it's such a small thing. And for us, driving at those speeds that he does and doing what he does at Ferrari, would think, oh, well, this has to be good enough. But when you get to that last little margin that Charles Leclerc can bring out of the car because he knows it so well, and that's what we're talking. And we're asking for perfection every day from these drivers. And that's quite difficult for us to understand, and we think, oh, it hasn't been a successful season. Well, it has. He's still scoring, you know, he had a sprint win and pole, and he's still scoring lots of points for Ferrari and keeping them in contention in the Constructors' Championship. It's been a pretty successful year, but he hasn't had the podium or the win. For Lewis's high standards, he wants that, but part of the work that he's doing at Ferrari is just to improve them from an operational point of view as well. And he's spoken a lot about that. The results of that might not be seen for a year or 2 years or 3 years, but that would be a great achievement if he can bring Ferrari back into that consistent winner's position.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about that chapter in your book. It's definitely my favorite chapter, the 2021 Abu Dhabi race. But just the way you've written this book, it's as if you're in the pit lane with you when you're reading. And I think your journalistic background has a lot to do with it. But, you know, I couldn't put this book down, but I have to ask. And I'm not going to even talk about that chapter, because it's a chapter where if you read between the lines, you can really get your honest opinion on what you thought. But what is your favorite part of the book? What's your favorite chapter?
Well, I mean, we're talking about Abu Dhabi 21, and that was an interesting one to write, because I start it by saying that you know, while everybody says it's controversial, the sort of dictionary definition of controversial, which is that some there's a debate over the facts of something that's happened. There's a controversy because some people think the facts are that this happened and some people think the facts are that that happened. It's disputed. Actually, in the case of Abu Dhabi 21, it's not really disputed. Everybody has had their say. A lot of it was broadcast live at the time. A lot of the team radio, all the team radio went out or was heard later. And everybody knows really what happened. So I don't really understand the controversy. There's something Toto Wolff says that I think Susie Wolff says of Toto Wolff, the Mercedes boss. He says, there are three things we don't talk about in this house, particularly over the dinner table. Religion, politics, and Abu Dhabi 2021. Because it just gets people so upset. But, you know, I really think it's just important for history's sake, really, that if you don't talk about things, then how are people going to learn for the future? So, I mean, I don't really have a particular view on. You said you think you can sort of see my view on it, and that chapter is written in a very factual way. And my views are pretty factual, really, in that if the FIA race director had applied the rules as they had been applied before and how they were normally applied, then it would be Lewis Hamilton who would have won that race, and he would be an 8-time world champion. But they weren't, and we all know the reasons why, because the race director wanted to get one more lap in, encouraged by the Red Bull pit wall, and so he did, and the FIA found that he was within his powers to do so, and that's why the race ended the way it did. So I don't think it was particularly controversial, but people seem upset about it. But sorry, your question. What was your question? Your question was
what's your favorite part of the book? Your favorite chapter?
Oh, okay. gosh, that's a good one. I mean, the Murray Walker stories.
Yeah.
And when I did the audiobook, and I would encourage if anyone likes audiobooks or wants me to read the book to them, then the audiobook is available. And I had fun doing that with the Murray Walker chapter, because I could do his voice, and it was quite fun to remember the nice times with Murray.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where I do a sort of, you know, a Gunter Steiner bit as well. The chapter about Drive to Survive was quite interesting.
Yeah.
To write, because it was making people think about how they put Drive to Survive together, and remembering that COVID year as well.
Yeah.
Which is a very difficult time for everybody. And we had to change the way we did programs quite a lot. And so, I'd say the chapters about Murray Walker were probably my favorite.
I could speak to you forever. And this has probably been one of my longest chats. But it's definitely probably been one of my favorite. And I just want to thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it so much for joining me.
No worries,
me today.
I enjoyed it.
That's it for today's episode. Join us next time on Driving with J9.